This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3367 for Tuesday, the 29th of June 2021. Today's show is entitled, Making Books with Linux, Part 1. It is hosted by Andrew Conway, and is about 56 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, a discussion about assembling books, using simple tools commonly found in most Linux distros.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Hacker Public Radio. This is Dave Morris. And today, McNallow and I, that's Andrew, are having a bit of a chat about a particular subject. So I think you're going to kick off today, Andrew. And do you like to talk about where we're coming from with this?
Yes. Well, thanks, Dave. Yes, and hello to all the HPR folks out there. Yes. Well, this is, I think, classic HPR material, in that it turned out that Dave had an itch and I had an itch, and we were both scratching our respective itches and discovered that they had something in common in how we were doing the scratching. I am talking purely metaphorically here, of course.
That's a relief to know.
Yep. With coronavirus restrictions, I can't scratch Dave, and I don't think he'd want me to anyway. But anyway, what I'm talking about, to be less generic, is that we're both generating documents to be published, made public, and we want to do it with simple sort of Unix-y, Linux-like text processing tools. So we both have ended up starting from Markdown, and we want to transform it into something we can put on the web, for example, or be published in some way. But we also are interested in doing processing, for example, for references, and also to make an index. I think it was generating an index for some material. That's the question that you asked that I latched onto.
Yes.
It's interesting to me as well.
That's right. Yes, I was searching for a generally available way of making an index out of a Markdown thing without really thinking it through, and you said that you'd done this and pointed me at your methodology, which approaches it from a route that I hadn't quite thought about. So yeah, there's lots of mileage there for talking about how it's done, and you know what we wanted to do, and ways and means of achieving it.
Indeed, and I should also mention that the route that I started down in generating a book, because that's what I'm doing, is I'm creating a book to be published by a regular publisher, ultimately. But the reason that I started down this route years ago, I think, was an HPR episode by John Culp, where he was. If I remember correctly, I think he might have been taking an out-of-print music book and republishing it under Creative Commons or public domain. I don't recall the details, but I really like the way he just kept it simple with a bit of. I don't know if he started from Markdown or HTML, but one of the two. A little bit of CSS. It was so light touch, and I thought that is just so simple. That's what I'm going to do, and I really have never regretted it. I'm able to automate everything about the whole process, rather than talk around it, maybe we should just get stuck in.
Yes. Well, we decided in our sort of pre chat that there was probably enough material here for a couple of shows, which I'm sure Ken would be applauding as he listens, cheering. So we would sort of give a summary of our two different positions and our needs and how we solve them and so forth, and maybe have a chat at the end. So today you are going to kick off with your situation, I think, Andrew. Yeah,
that's right. Yes, and you can quiz me and pull me up if I'm not being clear, and then we'll switch roles for the next one where you will discuss what you're doing and I'll quiz you as we go. Okay, so right, so yeah, I'm generating a book which is composed of chapters, and I have figures like graphs and charts, that kind of thing, and I also have tables in the book. But my starting point is essentially a text file. So each chapter is a text file, and it's in I write it in Markdown. I can also throw occasionally some HTML in there for something that's either not supported in Markdown or ambiguously supported, depending on the flavor of Markdown. So it's mainly Markdown with a little bit of HTML. And one of the actual bits of HTML comes in with the figures. Now, when I write and I want a figure in there, I actually just write in the text. I think I write a greater than sign, which I think means an indentation or something. I forget what the greater than sign means in Markdown. and then I write figure, and then ampersand NBSP semicolon for non-breaking space. And then I will write a tag like age underscore distribution, which shows the distribution of ages in the population. You know, and then when I want to discuss this figure somewhere in the text, I will just use that same tag, when that tag appears in the text. And an idea is that at some point in the post-processing, these tags will be found, numbered in order of in the chapter. So the first figure will be in chapter 3 will be 3.1, the second will be 3.2, and I don't need to worry about the references. Now, I mean, that's, I'm sure there's other tools out there to do that, and I know I've used LaTeX in the past to do this, but LaTeX was just too big a versatile hammer for this job. I want to keep it much more simple than that, as I said before. So that's the first job, is that I have references for the figures and tables. Now, not only that, but the other thing that my post-processing will do is it will, when it finds one of these figures, it then knows from that tag, like, I forget what I said before, but like ages underscore population, say. It will then go off to a directory, and it'll look for ages underscore population dot CSV. And if it finds that, it'll then fire up another script, which will turn that CSV into my figure. And the CSV file will contain not only the data, but some meta information about what the graph should look like, whether it should be a bar chart, mm-hmm. where the legend should be, if there should be a legend, all this kind of stuff, and the scale of the graphs. Right. So the principle was that every bit of material for the book starts life as a text file in this whole processing. And so the workflow is to write the source material, which I do entirely separately. And then when I'm ready, I then run a script. And the script then, it literally just takes the chapter. Some chapters don't have any figures, like the introductory chapter has no figures. So I can just literally, actually what I do is I take that chapter and I cat it to a file called all.markdown. And then I use Python, very short Python programs to go through and put in the references that I just described. And it also will generate the image file and the IMG tag, which is a bit of HTML that will go where the figure caption is in the chapter. And then it spits all of that out and appends it to the all.markdown file. So I'll call that for chapters 1, 2, 3, and it'll just go through and do the whole lot. And then tack on at the very end, it will spit out using cat again or an echo commands, just the end material that goes right at the end of the HTML file, mm-hmm. To close off the tags and stuff like that. And then I run it through markdown underscore py, and that takes the all.markdown file and generates the HTML file. And then the script that pulls all this together, well, then I can tell it to create a draft, which will then open up in the web browser automatically for me. So I can even, I have got this set up so that as soon as I save one of the chapter files, I use a command that will monitor the text file, see if they've changed, and if they have changed, run the script, and it will build everything and then immediately refresh the web browser so that I've got almost a live rendering of the book or a part of the book as I'm writing it. Because sometimes that's useful if you're checking layout and proofreading, and that's pretty useful.
I do something very similar, and it is immensely useful because you can prang your the look of your doc. I can only do I shouldn't say you can. I can make a horrible mess of my document without realizing. It looks fine in the markdown, but it's awful when it gets converted to HTML. So seeing that in as close to real time as possible helps me a huge amount.
Yes, I mean, I think, it's not WYSIWYG, but it's as close as you can get to it with this method. I mean, that is the downside of this method, is that it's not WYSIWYG, but then if you're used to, you know, writing HTML or LaTeX or any of the, or Markdown, you're used to not seeing exactly what you're going to get until later in the process. I should mention, I just looked, the way I did that automatically, it's just a one-line thing on the command line. If I'm working in chapter 5, the command I would issue would be ls chapter 5 dot markdown pipe, and the command then entr enter space, and then the name of the script, which in my case is called markdown to HTML. So that entr command is the one that effectively monitors, in this case, chapter 5, and it'll notice if I've changed anything to do with chapter 5, and then regenerate regenerate chapter 5 accordingly. Should I change it? So
that's cool.
So the other things that options I have is I've got basically four options. One is draft. In fact, there's five. One is draft. One is just to check references. That's many of my references, of course, web links. So the check references, all it does is goes through and checks all the links are valid and tells me if there's any, gets any 404s or 403s or something. What's the moved one, whatever the moved one is, or server error, that comes up occasionally. So the check refs is one. Draft is the working one that I mentioned. There's print, which is basically generating the final thing for the publisher. And then there's web, which I don't really use, but that I could use to put a version on the website. I haven't used that in a while. But the last one, will generate an ebook. So it'll generate, I think looking at it, it generates an EPUB, I think, although maybe it's actually more flexible than that. I wrote this so long ago, I don't actually quite remember what it does, but it definitely does generate an ebook of some kind. I can see that. I see lots of OPF and NCX files. I should also mention that a lot of the formatting takes place in the CSS file. That's a very important part of the process, in that I say nothing about how it should look beyond tags, formatting tags. The formatting, like what H1 means and what, you know, the P tag means, all of that stuff is kept strictly in the CSS file, and that actually greatly helps with keeping the draft, the print, the web, the ebook version all quite distinct, because that difference all takes place in the CSS file, really.
Okay. So yeah, that you have covered areas that I've been tangling with, because it's not just the book in my case. I actually came up with something similar for making my HPR show notes for any show of any complexity that I do. So I actually do two types of show as far as the computation is concerned, one of which is fairly simple. It's just like the notes are in the database on the HPR site, which is, you know, when you post stuff through the form, it gets dropped into the, or eventually gets dropped into the database, and that's what's served up when you go and look at an HPR page. But I also do a thing where I write longer, more complicated notes with images and whatever, and examples as a as a separate file that gets put up alongside the audio and stuff on the HPR website. So I wrote a thing which manages all of that, and I use make to build it. And I've got a thing that creates a make file, depending on what type of thing it is, and you know, whether it's got pictures in it, that sort of stuff. So I ended up looking at my book requirements with those eyes, thinking, oh yes, I could make a, in fact I have written a make file to manage it all, you know, so you can do make PDF and bang, out comes a PDF and that type of thing. But different approaches to the same sort of idea. Fascinating that we've come at the same similar problem in such different ways.
Yes, yeah. Now, it's interesting you should mention me, because I did look going down that route, because, you know, this feels like you're compiling the book, aren't you? I mean, it's like you compile computer code. It does feel very much like that, that I'm compiling the book. Now, why did I not go down the make route? I did look at it and then decided against it. I think it was just another layer of complexity I didn't want to tangle with. I felt that the bash script, I mean, I'm looking at everything I've just described is takes place in a bash script, and the bash script is only 57 lines long, and about a quarter of those lines are comments, you know, just to, so, you know, the majority of it, yeah, it's very simple actually. The bash script really only calls Python, my doRefs.py through Python, and it uses, as I mentioned, markdown underscore py. So that's it. You know, I don't think there's anything else other than that. It's all text based, you know, cats and echoes and pipes, redirects to a file. That's all there is. Yeah, so I think that was part of what I was, part of the simplicity that I was going for, is that really I wanted to use as few tools as possible. And Python is the only, what you might call, dependency that I've got here.
Yes. I came at this, as I said, I don't want to digress too much, but I came at this originally thinking, oh, wouldn't it be nice if there was a way in which you could make your HPR show relatively easily. I started writing a bash script to hand out to the world that would allow you to do things like bring together notes and maybe turn them into HTML through some route or whatever, and would even submit the show for you to HPR with all of your credentials in the days when we used to use FTP for it. But the thing grew and grew and grew. I'm terrible at coming up with an idea and then, you know, like Wallace and Gromit is attaching a few planks on the end and a big nail and stuff, and it grows, and you know, oh, that's stable, so I'll just put another chicken hut on the end of that, and you know, so you've come at it this from a much cleaner position, I think, a much simpler and more maintainable, I would imagine, goal.
I don't know. I mean, you were thinking of, you mentioned there, you were thinking of other people using your script, weren't you? That was a consideration, what you were doing.
It was, yeah, originally.
Yeah, but, and I think that's the difference, because this is just to scratch my own itch, this whole file. I'm perfectly happy. This particular file, the script I'm talking about, it isn't, I haven't put that online anywhere for people to hack around with, but the other components of this whole thing are the bit that does the figures, for example, and the index. They're all online. We can put the GitHub link in the show notes for those. But it's actually the reason the script isn't is that, well, you know, I'm still, it's only for my own personal consumption, so I'm slightly embarrassed about bits of it. And of course, there's bits of it that still have bespoke links to pass that only make sense in my file system. So I'd have to, you know, I'd have to do a bit of work before I could share it with the world. I feel a lot of other people might say, no, I just publish it. But you know, there's also the thing is, did I accidentally write my password in this window? I don't think I have.
Oh yes, yes. I go through the same sort of mental processes. Oh, it looks dangerous. I haven't got time to check it now. I'll do it later.
Yeah, well, you know that thing where you've got a command line window and I use SSH keys, but still sometimes you have to type in a password. and you type in, like, you know, for example, if you're doing a sudo or something like that, or su to root, and you know that thing where you're typing and you've forgotten which window you're in, and your password goes in plain text into another file and you don't notice.
Yes.
I've done that so many times. Well, maybe two or three times, but you don't notice it at the time. You think, why is my password not working? I'm pressing return. And then later on, you look in the text file and thinking, why are there like 10 new lines and my password in plain text in the text file?
Oh, yes. It's I have paranoia about this. I have to build systems that prevent me being an idiot in order to avoid. Just on that subject, actually, I'm using a thing called eChain that comes from Fun2, which lets you manage through SSH agent. You can give it a passphrase. I've got SSH passphrases, which I never had before. Give it a passphrase at the start of the day, and then it runs all day long, as long as your machine's up. And it feeds keys to whoever needs it and that sort of stuff. So that's made life a lot easier for me. I hardly ever type my passwords in.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, no, maybe that's something I should look into. That sounds useful. Anyway, we digress a little bit,
we do.
which is fine. You know, a bit of digression is fine. The other bit that I wanted to talk about, unless there was anything else that you wanted to go over first.
I'll talk a bit more about my stuff in the next show, I think. So rather than keep interrupting you.
Okay, no problem. Well, the next bit that I wanted to talk about is how I create the index. Now this is where we cross paths initially. Mm-hmm. And this was born of a conversation. I was sat over with the publisher of my book over in Edinburgh, I live in Glasgow, so yes, Edinburgh seems like a long way away, which is where you are, Dave, of course. So I'd gone over there specially, and we're having this conversation, and he said, you know, my book's full of facts and figures about Scotland, that's what it's about. And he was saying, yes, well, we don't really need an index in this book. And I think my look in my face must have been of utter horror, like, as a former academic and nerd, a book without an index, especially one that's factual. It's not like a novel or something which doesn't need an index. I was like, you know, I wish somebody had taken a picture of me, because I was horrified at the suggestion. And in fact, I pretty much said to him, I'm horrified. It's probably, you know, I try to moderate, you know, my reactions, but I was really genuinely horrified that he would suggest my book would not have an index. And then he went on to explain the technical difficulties. And I went, and then a bit of geek bravado kicked in. I went, oh, I could generate an index like that. And probably did snap my fingers. So, and he went, well, if Andrew, if you think you can generate an index that quickly, then yeah, let's do it. So the deal was that we'd get through the proofs, I'd make all my corrections, the very final version of the book, just before it went to the printers, they would send me the PDF, and my job was to then create an index. Now, I have talked to other authors, and they sit and they read through the book, the final copy of the book, and they write down a word, and then they write down the page number. I'm not having any of that nonsense. I'm far too lazy for that. So
I don't blame you.
Yeah. No, so the first thing I checked is I said to him, like, the PDF is a text-based PDF. It's not like an image that's going to the printers, and it wasn't. It was genuinely a text-based PDF, which is important, of course, because you can't parse an image. Well, you'd have to use optical character recognition, of which actually Ken has just released an episode about using some kind of character recognition, hasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, I saw that.
In the last couple of days. I think I did toy with that once, but it's very difficult to get right. No, much better if it's a text-based PDF. So that was the first win, that it was a text-based PDF. Not the figures, but as in the graphs, but all the text-based elements were in fact text. So my first job was, well, how can I turn that into a text file that I can then search, because I want it as text. I want to get rid of anything that's not text and just keep the words, because then, and the page numbers, you know, I need to know what the words are and what pages they're on. So I actually did quite a lot of hunting of different tools, and eventually in Slackware, it comes with some PDF tools. I can't remember the package that they're in, But the command that I found on Slackware, pre-installed as part of the Slackware install, was PDF to TO text. PDF to mm-hmm. text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it did everything I wanted. And I had to fettle with the command line switches and read the man page a bit. But essentially what it can do is you can give it a page range and of the PDF file. It will suck in the PDF file and spit out that page as text. And it, so that's the ideal thing, because if I can just produce one page of the PDF at a time of text, I know which page this is on, I've got the words, I can then do a script where I search through for a search term, and then I know that search term. Let's say the search term is GDP, for example, gross domestic product, GDP. I can then search for GDP in caps. I find it on that page, I then have an entry for the index. So I essentially just wrote a bash script that, working in that principle, went, it reads in a set of a text file called, I think it's called terms.txt, and these are words that should appear in the index, like GDP or economy or, you know, population, that kind of thing. And of course, there are times when you might want the word, and you might want to find the plural, you might want an acronym. So the way I set it up is that each line of the text file had GDP, I think I used a pipe character, then gross domestic product, and then I think I had pipe, then I had little keywords for plural that it would identify a plural, and it would, the code's actually quite simple, but it can distinguish words that should have a plural where it's ESS or IES, this kind of stuff. So so I just literally take a text file and I, in this very simple syntax, write down every search term that I want, and then this bash script uses PDF to text, and then a bit of some kind of regular expression searching to check whether which terms are on each page. And then at the end, of course, you then have to sort the terms into alphabetical order, and then put the list of page numbers or page ranges, because, you know, if you've got a hit on for a GDP on page 100, 101, 102, 103, you don't want to list all of these individually. You want it to be 100 to 103, whatever, 100-3, you know, is the style that's used in the book, or a comma-separated list of pages. And actually, there was a few gotchas. There was a few weird characters that upset it, and invisible characters, but I was able to catch all of them, you know, just a bit of grepping, search and replace, regexes crafted for the job. And it worked extremely well with a very small amount of fettling at the end. There was a few times where it really went to town on certain, like EU was a particular problem, I seem to remember, because although you wouldn't think it, EU kept appearing inside other words, and I can't remember. Yes. I can't remember. There was a problem. I had a problem with the EU, and it wasn't Brexit, not the EU as a body. I don't mean that, but I remember it generated, for some reason, it generated a huge number of hits to EU, more than made sense, and I couldn't quite get to the bottom of why. So I think it was a very short acronym. That was basically the problem. So I had to go in and do a bit of fettling and then improve the script a little bit. But then I sent, within a day, this was all turned around within a day, went back to the publisher, and they were astounded. They'd never seen an index turned around that fast before, and said, oh, could you share that script with us, please? And I'm thinking, really? Don't publishers have a standard tool for this job? I mean, I know they're quite a small publisher, these guys, but, you know, it was like as if it did feel like I discovered some kind of gold to them. Unfortunately, though, I couldn't actually get it working. The script wouldn't work reliably on Windows at the time. There was a few problems. I don't know what they were. Never got it working. And there was also problems with it working on a Mac, which surprised me, because I thought that would be closer to Unix. So those problems I never was quite able to solve. I should go back, but I think the main problem I couldn't solve it in the Mac, which they were using, is that I didn't have a Mac to test it out on. So so that would be an interesting project for someone else with a Mac.
Yes. So you pointed me out the GitHub
repository that contained a tool to do this, which is a Python script. So is that the sort of later development?
Yeah, sorry, it's a Python script. I said Bash script. There is a Bash script as well. That was an earlier version of it, and then I found a better way to do it. And
as you do, doing it in Bash and then going, oh no, I can't get this to work. I need something with a bit more oomph to it. So quite a reasonable thing to do. So yes, I've had a look at your. I've actually tried running your Python script, and it's it does a great job. Really good. It's a nice idea, and it, as you said, it's fairly simple in concept, but there's a whole bunch of things you need to cater for. But the principle of taking a page, looking for particular keywords, and then keeping a record of what you found, and then consolidating it all and printing it out at the end is great. It's perfect.
Yeah, no, it seems to, you know, actually, it's one of these things where when you start it, you think, oh, God, I think maybe I got a bit carried away when I said I could do this. And when you finally get it working, you think, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. But there was, along the way, there was quite a lot of gotchas, which don't, you know, like, you don't see them. And when I look at the script, it doesn't look that complicated. But I have to remind myself. I think a lot of the gotchas I got around by selecting command line options to PDF to text, and I can see there that I've got the EOL end of line option, the Unix option in particular are the two magic ones that solved a lot of my problems.
Yeah, PDF to text is a bit of an odd thing, isn't it? I have used it myself and not fully understood all the options. Bit trial and error was needed.
Yes, I think the thing that there was a lot of trial and error, but the trial and error was I tried different tools, and PDF to text was just the one that threw up the least number of problems. They all had problems, but quite a few of them were really couldn't handle boxes. I don't really understand how PDFs work, but some of them really just couldn't handle like figures and tables that like broke up the text, and they would just go a bit mental and throw a wobbly at that point, and the rest of the text on that page was garbage, you know. But PDF to text just seemed to ignore them completely, which I quite liked. You know, it said like, this isn't text, I'm not interested in this. On we go.
Yeah. PDF is a strange beast, isn't it? I think in some forms it's effectively PostScript embedded in a sort of container thing, I think, and that can be pretty hairy.
Yeah, PostScript. No, that's something I've not tangled with. I mean, PostScript is almost like a language, isn't it?
It's a Turing complete language.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being able to in my LaTeX days in the 90s being able to read PostScript and troubleshooting. I mean, not that I could really understand it, but. But it always looked very arcane and strange.
Oh yeah. It is. It needs a completely different mindset. But it's quite fun in its way. You've got nothing better to do. But it's. I think it's a great solution. My problem was that I had looked at doing this with EPUB, because EPUB is a whole different issue, because there aren't any pages as such. We're not sort of locked down pages. Is that right? I mean, basically, it's an HTML document in a container, isn't it?
Yes, it's just there's no concept of pages as far as I'm aware by default, and it just reflows the text depending on what size your screen reader wants to display it at. Now, having said that, I've got a feeling that I have read books that somehow have some notion of page numbers inside them, but I don't really understand. It seems to depend on how the book was, how the EPUB or whatever format was created. So I wouldn't swear to EPUBs being unable to mark real page numbers. I can see it being a useful thing in a textbook. You might want to refer it to an actual physical page in the print book, but might have only access to the EPUB. So it would seem to me that that would be a useful feature for EPUBs to support.
Having said that, it's probably worth going and unpacking a textbook of some sort. I'm sure I have some EPUB textbooks knocking around. That, and if you, it's a zip gzip thing, isn't it? You can just explode it and then look at all the bits. I know this is another John Culpism, by the way. He was the first person I ever heard who explained what was inside an EPUB, and I never knew. But so he'd done a lot of hacking of EPUBs over the years, I think.
Yes, I think you're right. I think I'm just looking back at my script. I think all this HTML, CSS, OPF, NCX, those are the files that you will find inside an EPUB. Mm-hmm. And if so, then there will be no way of tracking, at least in the EPUBs I created of my book, you're correct, there will be no way of tracking the pages that in the print version. That would need to be, if that is possible, I don't know if it is, that would be, need some other clever tool to come along and compare the PDF or whatever was generated for print with the EPUB. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mm-hmm. even know if that's possible. I mean, I could see how to do it actually in principle, but I don't know if EPUB in any way supports that.
No. I think the Pandoc processor for Markdown has got some sort of a cross-referency type feature to it, I think. And I'm a bit vague about this because I haven't dug into this in detail, but I think the principle is that you put an anchor against the word, which is something you want to index, and then you make an index table effectively that refers to those instances through their anchors. Does that make sense? No, yeah. It doesn't really. Well, you got GDP everywhere. Could you anchor it multiple times? How do you get?
I don't know. Actually, it's a good point you bring up. I did look at, when I was researching how to do this at the beginning, I did look at Pandoc. I mean, Pandoc is fantastic. You know, is it the one that calls itself the Swiss Army knife or something or other?
I don't know. It's brilliant, though. It's very clever.
It is brilliant. What's it written in? Is it?
It's Haskell.
Haskell, that's right. Yeah, so yeah. I had two problems with Pandoc. The first one is it's Haskell. Nothing against Haskell, but just the way the Haskell comes in about a bazillion different packages.
Yes. Install Pandoc from scratch, and you wait a long time for all of the Haskell stuff.
Yeah, and that is one of the very rare times that I found the package management on Slackware to be a problem. Mm-hmm. Is that with a package like that, which you have so many dependencies just because of the way it's packaged. But anyway, that's one thing. But the other more fundamental thing that I had with that is, you know, you don't want to eat your dinner with a Swiss Army knife. I mean, you could, in principle, with two Swiss Army knives, turn them into knife and fork and eat, but you'd rather just use a knife and fork. So this is my problem with Pandoc here, is it did a lot of the things I wanted to do, perhaps all of them, but I just felt it was cumbersome. It got away from the simplicity. You know, using a knife and fork, that would do me. My project was not complicated enough. Or tricky enough to deserve Pandoc, I don't think. Had I already been acquainted with Pandoc, I might have used it, actually. But I wasn't well enough acquainted with it. I would have to then install everything from scratch in this occasion because I haven't used it for a while. So Pandoc is great, but I just felt, you know, it was too complicated. Not a sledgehammer to crack a nut, but using Swiss Army knives to eat your dinner would be the analogy I would use.
Yes, you might leave one of those blades out and cut yourself.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, yeah. The bottle opener might spring open and poke you in the eye or something.
So, be trimming your nails with the scissors by accident and things like that. Yeah. No, I take your point. I have been playing with Pandoc for a long time now, so I don't feel too uncomfortable using it, but I can. It is, and it changes quite often, and you think, oh, that doesn't seem to work anymore. I wonder why. And you go and look at it and say, oh, we've improved it. Okay. The simpler approach is less full of surprises.
Indeed, yeah. It's personal preference. It's just how I wanted to do it, you know. I mean, I quite like understanding what I'm doing and using I really just like this Unix philosophy of lots of simple tools that are focused in one particular job. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I find that works best for me generally. I find I'm losing my hair naturally as I age anyway, but it means I don't have to pull any more out while I'm frustrated.
No, fair enough. Just a couple of points on the subject of tools. I've had two approaches made apparent to me. One is Jeroen, who's a contributor to HBR, who has written quite a number of books, and he has become very, very much enamored of ASCII-DOC, or ASCII-DOC-TOR, which is a rewrite of the original ASCII-DOC, and he reckons that is better than Markdown, etc. I do use it a little bit, but I couldn't say what my opinion was on bookmaking with it. The second one is my son, who did an Open University Maths course, you got extra points for submitting your stuff in LaTeX. And he's currently doing an MSc in Computer Science, where you do get a few brownie points if you send stuff in there later. So he is really quite knowledgeable about it. And he said, it's easy to make an index with LaTeX, which it wasn't in the days then I used it. It was back in the 1980s or something, late 80s. But apparently it is. And, you know, it doesn't look like it used to back in the day anymore. Of course, there's lots of whatever they are, extensions that let you produce really nice looking documents. So they're both quite long learning curves, I think. So just for the record, it's worth knowing that these two possibilities maybe exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I did look at ASCII-DOC. I don't think that, you know, I think I could have happily used that instead of Markdown. Why did I go with Markdown? I just, because I already knew it. And it was, I mean, there's hardly any formatting that I use for Markdown, a very little. It's mainly just text that I'm using, so it didn't really matter. I didn't want to use HTML because, that is cumbersome to write compared to Markdown.
It is.
I just, when I'm writing, I just like to write in plain text. When I'm writing the book, the prose, I don't want writing a plain text, and a simple text editor is my preference. As for LaTeX, I wrote my PhD thesis in LaTeX and lots of papers when I was an academic. If you want to do maths, to this day, I really, LaTeX is the way to go. It just produces the most beautiful typeset maths. There's no maths in my current textbook, in the book that I'm publishing here. If there had been, I would have gone down the LaTeX route like that. It would have been the obvious choice. But because I wasn't, I don't know. I felt I could have used LaTeX. I really could have done. I haven't really even thought about why I didn't, other than there was no maths in it.
It was the case that whenever you produce something with LaTeX, it looked the same. It looked like, you know, enormous margins, and the font used was, I'm talking about my day, which was the early days of LaTeX preps in about, 87 onwards. But that's some people got a little bit prejudiced against that because, you know, everything they produced looked the same, whether it was a paper or a shopping list or something. I think that any of those feelings should be reviewed.
Yes. I mean, I know exactly what you mean about LaTeX all having the same look. I'm trying to think why that would have been. Back then, why you didn't see? You're right. I don't remember ever seeing anyone use anything other than the standard font that it gave you. But of course, I know that isn't true.
It looked really nice, but you know everything was the same. You couldn't make a fancy looking book where you know you had margin notes or you know interesting chapter headings and stuff that you would. You could do it, but it all was in the same font and looked like, oh, that's a LaTeX document, obviously.
You could do it, because I submitted papers to journals, and when they would, even at that time, this is in the 90s, they preferred you. LaTeX was such a smooth process for them. It cut down on all their typesetting overhead. They preferred to use it, but the final product did not look like LaTeX. It looked like the house style for that journal. A few journals ended up looking like LaTeX, but those ones, those long-standing professional academic journals, even then they were able to put it in two-column format with our custom fonts and heading styles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
I think it was probably always there. It's just that you needed to open the door to the tech underneath it, and then be a bit shocked by how complex it is.
Yeah, I think that must be the point. Yeah, that's that. I mean, back then I would have been very up for doing that, but the only person I ever remember going and getting involved in that was the same person who could pretty much speak Postscript. Not that you need the Postscript for that. I'm just saying that's the level of intellectual geekery that he had ascended to, where you know he could really, you know, I always joked with him that he could go up to a Postscript printer and speak to it, and it would pop a perfectly formatted graph or something.
Yes, and how are you? I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yes. So that was. So I think that's just covered all the stuff that I'd done. So we'll look forward to talking to you next time, Dave, and thinking about what you've been up to for HPR.
I'll give you a summary of a similar nature, and we can maybe sort of kick around the ideas and come up with some different views, etc., etc. That would be fun. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So, we'll say goodbye to everybody and see you next time.
Righto. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.